I wanted to ask also about one element of your campaign having to do with a Green New Deal and mm-hmm. where you see libraries fitting into that. Now, obviously, libraries can play a role in educating the public about climate change and what we can do about it. But what in what they're actually doing can libraries be doing to address climate change?
Well, I think when I think about libraries as part of a Green New Deal as public institutions, because like I can't actually think of another public institution that takes up real estate the way that libraries do. Schools, you know, but in terms of non-coercive public space for people of all ages to come inside, you know, we're the only ones, you know, where you don't come in and get sold something. Like that's us. That's kind of it. And so I think to the extent that a Green New Deal is about pushing reinvestment in physical institutions and infrastructure, we have to be a part of that. And I think that's really important. I also think we can argue about libraries and how they have failed society and the ways that they, you know, racial exclusion is at the root of libraries, the sort of paternalistic effort to, you know, inform the working classes about better ways to be, you know, all of those things are true, but also libraries are kind of amazing and they're kind of great and they kind of do good things. And like, they're really institutions that it's much easier to mobilize them on behalf of justice than say like the post office. So we're inclined in those ways. And so I think, you know, sustainability is a core value now for the American Library Association. It has, the association has set up infrastructure for environmental conversations and sustainability efforts. Rebecca Smith Aldrich is a librarian here in New York, has done an amazing organizing job around sustainability in New York State libraries and across the country, but really in New York State, there's a lot of really good stuff happening. And so I think because we are good, you know, with all of the qualifying scare quotes around that, I think we can be sites for environmental activism in a way that other institutions can't be.
You mentioned sustainability, and one way that we could be doing better as stewards of material resources mm-hmm. is in just how we actually take care of them, because libraries used to have to repair and mm-hmm. maintain everything because, you know, books were not produced as readily 100 or more years ago. Production techniques, extraction techniques have brought all of those costs down so that it is more economical to just throw out a book, which is often designed to be disposable, mm-hmm. than it is to repair it and give it however many more circs it's going to get. And I feel like that is a trend in our society, but then also just in collection management that we could be doing better to push back against and basically say, we're not always going to have shiny new books on the shelves. We're going to have books that are cared for, though.
Yeah, there's a bindery crisis. Like during the pandemic, a bunch of the binderies closed. So if you want to send out your book for rebinding, there are like fewer and fewer places you can send it. It's like a crisis. Also, like we have, I think, pivoted to digital in some fairly uncritical ways, as if digital materials don't have very extraordinarily high resource costs. So there's a lot of reckoning with our use of digital materials, as well as, I think you're right, the like, could the library be a site for sort of right to repair movements to really take off, rather than conceiving of our maker spaces as just for business innovation, which is how they're normally pitched, you know? But if I'm going to pitch that and have it be successful, that's why I need to link whatever I'm doing, activism I'm doing in and around the library, to broader social movements that would make that possible.
Well, yeah. And you would think that there would be a big buy-in across libraries, because that would mean jobs. That would mean labor hours that have to be put to that kind mm-hmm. of work. And, you know, there's something more wholesome about repairing and taking care of things than clicking the marketplace button that'll just send another one from Amazon.
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of disposability stuff that we have to reckon with, and that libraries traditionally, you know, one of our roles has been to preserve for use over time. But, you know, we're, a lot of us really stuck in a sort of innovation story, when I think what we need is really, you know, to pay attention to what it is that libraries do best, which is make space and knowledge available. And I think we could do that ethically if we chose to.
Yeah, you brought up ebooks, and it's a question that a fellow library worker had kind of pitched to me to bring up, which is that, is there anything the ALA could be doing to kind of create a counter publishing institution for digital resources? Because ebooks were pushed on libraries and in the broader public to some extent, saying, hey, we're going to save trees. Mm-hmm. And in libraries, you have checkout limits on these, you know, infinitely checkoutable items.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, here it's because publishers want to enforce this scarcity and get their money's worth out of everything. Could the ALA, you know, use those economies of scale, since it wouldn't have to produce books, it would just have to manage server space or something.
Mm-hmm.
Is there room for the ALA to kind of create a public option for ebook publishing that would then get around those artificial scarcities?
I mean, I don't know, right? Like, we would have to find out. But I think that, like, does the association have that capacity? I don't know. I think there are other entities that are sort of moving in that direction with, like, controlled digital lending. I'm less sort of familiar with those kinds of projects, but I think, you know, we see what most actors in the space are doing, and it's to, you know, most of what we do is try to maximize profit, right? That's most of what everybody is doing. And so could ALA be a counter to that? I don't know. It would have to be a different kind of ALA than the one it is now, I think. I mean, I think part of what my election means, at least from where I sit, is that we can have more of these open conversations. Like, I think it doesn't feel like an honorific. It feels like a real opportunity to, like, get people together in a room to talk about what we care about, and sort of making room for people with commitments to the public and commitments to each other to, like, mm-hmm. be driving the conversation seems really exciting.
I know that you said in one interview that with the, like, $75,000 discretionary budget you'll get, that you thought of, like, funding labor notes trainings in libraries or somehow adjacent to them. Is that something that you're still considering?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know how it works, or even if that's the amount or what I get to, how discretionary it really is. But I think my goal is to make sure that during my time as president, more people know the basic how-tos of organizing than did before I got there. And what shape that takes, I'm not totally sure. My own experience in a labor notes training was transformative. It's one of the only times I've ever been in a room with organized labor from across the spectrum, like everybody in the country, like Teamsters, longshoremen, Verizon workers, Starbucks workers, I'm sure we're going to see, teachers, librarians, all those people. And so you don't often get to be in a cross-class, I don't get to have cross-class experiences very often, you know, and the library space is one of those places where you can have those encounters. But labor notes, where everybody understands that it is only through collective action with each other as workers that we really sort of, like, who sees that as, like, the primary driver of change. It's sort of, I'd like to more people to have that experience because it was really transformative for me. That's where our resources need to be going. And, you know, over the last 5 years, I've sent out probably 500 copies of Secrets of a Successful Organizer. I try to put that in the hands of every single person that I meet who has a complaint about their boss, because that's the only way you're going to win. It's a good how-to. It's, like, should be required reading in library school.
I mean, and I have a lot of hope for libraries being catalysts for other sorts of organizing. We did a lot of tenant organizing in Portland about 5-7 years ago when mm-hmm. gentrification was just on fire in town. I got evicted. Lots of people got evicted. We had renters assemblies that, like, because I've been working for the library for 8 years now.
Mm-hmm.
I, like, said, we have to do these in the library. It's free space, and it's going to make people feel like there's something legitimate about it, because there's a social cachet that the library casts on whatever happens in its walls.
It's that public space accessible to all kind of thing. Like, we have material infrastructure that can help people, you know, and we've sort of framed it mostly as the sort of, like, you know, access to tech, but it's also just, like, access to space to be with one another. And that's no mm-hmm. small thing.
Yeah. And there's ways in which there's contradictions in that access, because, like, management right now, they want to say that, well, the library is changing and we need to, like, make more space and be more flexible for community events, which sounds okay. But they're also talking about devaluing, I think, the work that goes into maintaining the collection. Automation is one way that happens. Just the fact that when we got a $15 minimum wage in our contract 6 years ago, they said that your jobs to the pages who are getting an increase because of that, your jobs aren't worth that. So we're going to give you more work so that the taxpayers are getting the value they deserve.
I mean, I don't even know what you say to that. It's just an absolutely I don't know why we would treat each other that way. It just is mystifying to me why we would choose to have that as sort of the form of our social relations. But like the dream for me is that when people hear about their library or a library in their community doing something like that, that we all feel like we can do more than be mad about it. That rage without a way of acting on it in a collective way that builds our community, it's just will eat you to death. And I can't wake up every morning knowing that I'm right, but the people who are wrong have all the power, right? Because that is just a recipe for despair. And we don't have time for despair. There's too much we have to do. There's too much that needs to be different. And so I want the first thought somebody has when they're like, I can't believe my boss is doing that, not to be, I guess I hate the boss and I have to get a new job, but what are we going to do to get something different to happen, to change that decision? And that is like that is the question that we have to always be asking ourselves and asking each other and putting ourselves into positions where we can learn how to do that. And that's sort of the gamble I made with running for president, that I'd be able to talk to enough people and like generate enough excitement and figure out enough ways to like bring people together to sort of build that capacity for us. We'll see what I can actually do, but you know, not me, us, right? It's going to take all of us.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. I've been talking with Emily Drabinsky, the new president-elect of the American Library Association. Thanks for coming on The Old Mole, Emily.
Thank you so much.